Are you tired of working with generic IT providers that rely on you to be the expert? Arc IT goes beyond just fixing your tech headaches. They specialize in proactive IT management, BIM support, and data security for your architecture firm. The team at Arc IT gets your tech so you can focus on doing your best work. Whether you're a small firm of 10 or a growing practice with 50 or more employees, unleash the full potential of your creative vision with Arc IT. Visit getarcit.com and schedule your free IT assessment today. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Dina Prastos, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It's my pleasure to be here.
I'm excited to have this conversation. Today, we're going to dive into the fluid world of waterfront architecture with Dina Prastos, the pioneering founder and CEO of Indigo River. As the profession's first waterfront architect, Dina leads her women-owned firm with a clear vision, blending design, technology, and nature to craft resilient, climate-adaptive spaces along the water's edge. From the dynamic East Side coastal resiliency in Manhattan to the innovative Wildflower Studios in Astoria, Dina's expertise in navigating the complexities of marine engineering and waterfront architecture is transforming New York Harbor and beyond. Born in Alaska, her appreciation for nature and mastery of infrastructure in challenging environments inform her holistic boundary-transcending approach. So stay with us as we explore how Indigo River is charting new courses in architecture and what this means for the future of our coastal communities. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I am a water baby. I grew up every weekend visiting a lake house with my mom and dad. My mom and dad still have a house up at the St. Lawrence River, upstate New York, right on the border of Canada. In the winters, I go visit my mom and dad down in Florida and spend a whole bunch of time in the Gulf. And so the water is my place. And so I love being at the waterfront. And so having this conversation about what you do at Indigo River, Dina, I think is going to be a really interesting conversation. So I'm really excited to have you here.
And I'm excited to be here. Thank you again.
All right. So before we jump into that conversation, I want to know more about you. I want to learn about when you discovered your passion for what you do, and maybe even who or what inspired you to get started as an architect.
Absolutely. So I, as you mentioned, I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and I think just rooted in my upbringing, being immersed in nature, having an appreciation for nature and natural forces, and thereby built infrastructure in some of our world's most harsh and extreme environments, that's kind of ingrained in me from a young age. And so even when I knew I wanted to be an architect and I went through a 5-year architecture program, I finished the program around 2007, 2008, kind of the downturn of the economy. And I had a kind of practical step back in terms of what the economy was doing and how I wanted to slightly differentiate my skill set and my offerings young in my career. And so I immediately kind of doubled down in an area that I felt slightly insecure, maybe as a weakness, that I didn't feel like I had a technical enough understanding of how things get built. And so I got a master's in civil engineering and I finished that program. And again, having, you know, slightly boosted my technical skill set and confidence on, you know, calculations on a sheet of paper, what different structural systems to choose, I wanted to round out my, again, more practical understanding of how and why things get built in the field the way they do, why materials are selected, how they go together, what the laborers are saying in the field. And so I very deliberately made my first step into the profession into a self-perform heavy civil contractor. And by chance, I mean, now it's a foreshadowing, but by chance, the first project that I was put on, and I was there for a couple of years, was a Staten Island Ferry Terminal. And so we have it a waterfront project. It was a design build project. I was on the contractor side, but I was, my role, I mean, I field engineer, project engineer, kind of worked my way up through the standard contractor positions for construction management. But again, design build, I was working more closely with the designers and liaising speaking that same kind of architectural vocabulary that I had already learned from my academic background. And so that, I think, really kind of teed up a general understanding of the industry, of the profession, of the players, to form an empathy that, full circle, I ended up later working for a marine engineering firm, working on many other coastal projects through a kind of problem-solving engineering lens, project management, until I then worked for an architecture firm for a period of time before I saw the opportunity to practice as an architect in this space. And all the while, I mean, engineers have their specialties, they have their different vertical areas of focus, whereas architects don't really have that same specialization focus. We are largely generalists, but I did see the opportunity. Many of the rooms I sat in, there were no other architects having these kind of broad strokes decisions and discussions around public infrastructure. And so the writing was on the wall for me that there was an opportunity as an architect to form a firm focused on this space, and especially in this day of popular conversation around climate adaptation, climate change, what we can do focusing on a very vulnerable natural condition, which is where nature meets man-made, where water meets land, and really kind of expand from there. But that's the theme that permeates all of our work.
Yeah. Exciting in so many different ways. You know, the opportunity to impact the world in a very big way in a place where architects weren't really having that impact the way they should. And so seeing that opportunity to go there as an architect and have that influence in the way our built environment is impacting the natural environment. Thank you, first of all, for leading the way there, and not only doing it and doing it in a way that helps our environment, but also showing other architects how they can be doing similar things when they see opportunities like that to stand up and become leaders, I think is a very important, not only for our environment, but for our profession, that more architects do similar things to what you've done. Before we jump into specifically what you do, I want to just go back just one step. So you started in Alaska and you ended up in New York City. Was that just school and you ended up in New York? How did you make that transition from Alaska to New York?
So I knew early on I had family friends that were architects, and kind of with the latest different, you know, licensing schemes of how individuals were eligible for licensure. And I thought early on I wanted to be licensed, which I kind of lost sight of for a bit in the middle of my career. And that wasn't always a driving force. But initially when I was selecting a school, I was encouraged to select a five-year program. And Alaska doesn't have any five-year programs. They have a lot of great engineering programs, but not an architecture program, and certainly not a master's of art to get licensed, nor a five-year program. And so for me, it was a simple decision to look outside of the state. And my filter, I was an athlete growing up and I got a soccer scholarship. And so my filter for my college search was a Division I athletics program where I was eligible for scholarship and a five-year architecture program. And there aren't many to begin with, but there really aren't many.
So did you say D1 soccer and architecture?
Yes. And so there are not many coaches. Wow. I had coaches flat out tell me if I wanted to play for their program, I could not study architecture, especially in a five-year program, which we know is very intensive.
Yeah, I have two D1 athletes in my family, my daughter and my son. My daughter swims and my son rowed. And it was very clear when you become a D1 athlete that architecture is off the board. There's no way you can do both, right? Because of the time dedication.
You can.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. Very impressive.
And it, you know, I took a school, a supportive athletic director, but it was something that was important to me. I ended up being a three-year captain. I ended up continuing to student coach even through my master's program. And so it was possible. It certainly speaks to, you know, time management, prioritization skills early on. I actually had, you know, several other jobs during college. And so certainly can be done. And I'll say that all with the fact that I never pulled an all-nighter. So one of the few archies that was not, I mean, I had some late nights, but I wasn't routinely or regularly pulling an all-nighter, as you can imagine, not healthy for athletes not to get sleep.
Yes. Yeah. Very, very impressive that you did that. But also says a lot about you and how you've got to where you are today, right? That if you had the discipline to be able to be a D1 athlete, that alone requires tremendous discipline. But then to also complete an architectural education at the same time and never doing an all-nighter, which I have my own feelings about all-nighters. I don't think anybody should be doing all-nighters.
Agreed.
I think that that's a choice, despite what lots of people think. But you can clearly see how that discipline that you have can lead to building a firm like you've done with Indigo River, for sure. Well, that's why I love going back and understanding how those connections are made and what you did along the way, because it does lead us back to Indigo River because it's a very unique firm. And so that's where I want to go next. I want to just explain, first of all, the vision for Indigo River. When did it start and what's your vision for it?
So I would say the seed was planted when I was managing some large-scale, high-profile projects for other firms. And I would, again, often be the only architect unlicensed at the time, but the only architect or architect background in the room. I was in a room full of, you know, client-side, different agency members or different regulators, and then, of course, the engineering team. We work with a lot of engineers. I have an engineering background as well. Engineers are great at what they do, but they are problem solvers, and they are more apt to follow guidelines and standards and not necessarily think outside of the box or think in terms of human experience, which is what architects are trained to do, to see the opportunity to understand and to empathize what that experience will be, and especially for different populations, different demographics. And so I saw the opportunity early on just by lack of, you know, having a mentor in the field, lack of anyone that I could turn to. And I, at one point, was at a firm getting my architecture experience, getting my hours required for licensure. And it wasn't a particularly healthy environment. I wasn't working on particularly exciting projects or any project that really resonated with this, you know, passion and mission of nature and man-made and kind of fusion thereof. And I was looking for a firm to move to, and I was kind of scouring, you know, near New York City, looking in and out of all firms and maybe slightly even considering going to a landscape architecture firm, but trying to find something that I couldn't, and both in terms of practice area as well as in terms of culture. And there was no perfect fit. And so that was kind of the writing on the wall for me to make what I couldn't find and make a progressive firm that also utilizes the latest technologies, not scared to pivot and change direction, be agile, try new things, and work alongside partners and team members that we've, you know, forged relationships early in our careers and been able to kind of reattract that same talent as we've grown. No two individuals on our team have the same experience. We are truly multidisciplinary. And so we have expanded from, you know, typical, I'd say, engineers or even architects to have engineers, architects, and planners, but very diverse in our skill set and in our backgrounds and experience. And so within engineering, we certainly have, I'd say, the more typical civil engineers, but we also have structural engineers, marine engineers, geotechnical engineers, coastal engineers, dive engineers. So a lot of different specialties, environmental engineers. And then within architecture, we have, I'll put air quotes, traditionally trained building architects. None of us who have really focused our career on buildings, period. We focused on infrastructure, kind of large scale public works projects, as well as we have naval architects that focus on floating assets. We have landscape architects. And so we have, you know, different areas of architecture, all related again to the waterfront and what we do. And then planners, we have more, you know, thinking at different scales, thinking, you know, urban planners, waterfront planners, environmental planners, as well as true climate adaptation specialists that are a little more scientific in their work. And so that fusion really truly is multidisciplinary, but allows us to work on the waterfront from different vantages, not only in terms of our educational backgrounds, but also many of us, similar to my background, that I've worked in construction, I've worked in design engineering, I've worked in design architecture. Many of our individuals have also had, you know, construction experience. They've been the contractor, they've had their own firm, or they've been in the field with the laborers, understanding what the issues are. They have a network of contacts that they can pick up the phone and call. Or they've been, you know, on the agency side or on the owner's side as a representative for the owner. And so we have a lot of empathy kind of built into the core of our team.
So did you mention when you actually legally started?
We formed in 2018.
2018, okay.
So we're in our seventh year.
And how many people in the firm?
Just about 20.
So very unique firm, right? Has all these different disciplines. What type of projects are you doing? Explain the types of projects that you're doing. I know you're doing public infrastructure projects, but more specifically, what type of projects are you working on?
So really anywhere, any condition that you can think of where water meets man-made. And so that can be a port facility, a marina facility, a ferry terminal, a ferry landing. It can also be, you know, vertical conditions of a bulkhead or a seawall, a wharf, a quay, an esplanade, a park on the water, beach renourishment. It can be, you know, riprap rehabilitation, fendering systems. So it can be a lot of different types of structures and a lot of different types of programmatic uses. But again, with this theme of waterfront being in a marine environment, I'll say we've expanded a bit just because we are so comfortable working in on with the water and its, you know, the natural forces. We work also on many flood mitigation projects. And so we look at different strategies for how communities deal with water, even in, you know, extreme events, extreme circumstances. And so that's something that the marine engineering has really expanded beyond literal marine engineering to be more wide cast, you know, climate adaptation solutions with regard to flood vulnerabilities.
Yeah. And you're working all across the United States or specifically in New York?
Probably 70% of our portfolio is in New York Harbor and in the Northeast, but we do work down the coast in Florida, in the Carolinas. We work in Canada. So we do have some in the island. So we have some different international projects, but primarily based out of New York Harbor.
Yeah. So New York Harbor, being born and raised in New Jersey and living most of my adult life in New York, just north of New York City, I remember Hurricane Sandy and some of the big hurricanes that came through that area that flooded New York City. I'm sure lots of that was sort of a reminder to the leaders in New York City that they need to start doing some resiliency, some climate change adaptation work. Was that sort of the spur to some of that work that's happening today?
Absolutely. And I think it's opened up and it's increased the momentum with which we are able to practice in this space. So kind of a key awareness that, yeah, when you have a vulnerability that's exploited, especially in a high profile area like New York, and then, you know, followed by government dollars and subsidies and things to get the city kind of rebuilt back better, the emphasis and the focus affords firms like ours to practice in that space. And so I lived in Hoboken, New Jersey at the time of Sandy, and it was one of the worst hit areas. And I have that kind of experience ingrained in me. I was working for the contractor at the time that was called on an emergency basis to go and help pump out one of the PATH stations that's, you know, major transit into New York City. And so certainly the importance and the emphasis of, you know, why this work is important and how vulnerable we really are began to resonate at that time, if not earlier. And I'll say, even, you know, incidents since Sandy, even, you know, terrorist attacks, 9/11, we look at how diverse transportation helps dense environments, helps cities like New York, where evacuation routes are not limited to subways or tunnels or bridges that we can, you know, evacuate by water. Or in the case of Sandy, where tunnels are flooded, how, you know, alternate means of transportation are so important. And having that diversity set up within an urban environment and context is so important.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. As an architect or firm owner, you might find yourself swamped with drawings that take up most of your day, leaving you with little time to manage your business. MGS Global Group can lighten your load by handling all of your drafting and rendering needs. Their experienced team of architects and designers can convert your schematic designs into DDs and CDs with minimal supervision. With expertise in industry-leading tools like Revit, ARCHICAD, and more, MGS is the perfect partner for managing your project spikes and urgent tasks. They work as an extension of your team and follow your standards to ensure the quality and accuracy of your drawings. Having served sole practitioners, small firms, and publicly traded companies since 2008, MGS guarantees you get the help you need right when you need it. Visit mgsglobalgroup.com and book your free consultation today. That's mgsglobalgroup.com. ARCHAT's Spec Wizard is the tool that will help you save time writing specifications. Going through the manufacturer's specification line by line to find the right product leads to frustration and errors, and that's where Spec Wizard comes in. It's a free, patented tool that allows you to select products and options error-free and generate a three-part specification in minutes. Go to ARCHAT.com, that's ARCHAT.com, and try Spec Wizard today. What's your typical competition, right? Because your firm is very unique. I don't know of any other firms that are built like yours. So is it typically just big construction companies or big engineering companies that you're competing with?
I mean, yes, we have competitors in the space that do things that we do, but we are very versatile in our skill sets and in our offerings that we often find ways to team even with, you know, individuals that we would maybe on paper consider to be competition. And one of the reasons and one of the ways that we do that is when we work especially on government projects that have set-asides for women-owned businesses, that's the criteria that we're eligible to fulfill. And so we work on a lot of, you know, larger scale projects that we wouldn't necessarily be eligible to prime, but we get kind of a foot in the door as a sub, as a mentee mentorship protege program. And so that's, I wouldn't say we compete with the larger firms, but we kind of are able to augment and offer specialty skill sets. And that, again, from my experience earlier in my career, I've worked for large contractors. I worked for large engineering firms that were primes and struggled to find qualified, eligible, productive women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses within the specialty space like this. And so that's something that, again, saw the opportunity beyond just the subject matter expertise of what we do, but an ownership structure that is complementary to much of the funding that's out there.
Got it. So there's an advantage of having the sort of the situation that you have, being a woman-owned firm, having the type of background that you have, the size of the firm, all of that sort of leads to having to be able to focus on the projects that you're focused on.
Absolutely.
From a business point of view, focusing so specifically on that type of infrastructure architecture where water meets land, has that helped from a business point of view? Do you feel that you have an advantage compared to other architecture firms that are more diverse, more generalists that you talked about earlier? Is there an advantage to focusing so clearly on one specific niche?
Absolutely. And that's something that I advocate largely for within the architectural community is to embrace specializations and embrace, you know, specialty areas of expertise, because there are areas of our industry that are deeply saturated. And, you know, frankly, coming out of school or even aspiring when I was in school, you know, what I would have dreamed to work on, sure, you know, luxury housing projects, things that would, you know, appeal, but those markets are already deeply saturated in terms of talent, in terms of experience. And so trying to break in and get a foot in there, just barrier to entry was greater in my mind. And so certainly, you know, I embraced the practical side and the technical side of my background. But also there's, you know, less competition in the space. And that's not to say that there isn't plenty of work and plenty of opportunity. And I invite more to join in the space because it is, I mean, it's certainly gratifying work. It's, you know, mission-driven, purpose-filled work that is necessary, especially at this moment in time as the climate is changing, to have a focus and an emphasis not on, you know, virgin sites, new builds, but on how we are adapting our current built environment to account for future more extreme weather patterns.
Are you doing anything? You're obviously visiting podcasts and talk. I've heard you on other podcasts as well. Are you doing other things to sort of help grow and build your firm and advance your mission at Indigo River?
Absolutely. So we partner with several other kind of small, like-minded firms, minority-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses. We are active within emerging markets like offshore wind and renewable energy. I volunteer with NCARB, National Council of Architecture Registration Boards. I chair their Futures Collaborative that we look at, you know, the future of the profession, the future of licensure. And so that's where we get, you know, deeply kind of ingrained sometimes in, you know, what are the trajectories for the future and what's happened historically, where are we now, and what's the writing on the wall for how we need to course correct or shift to achieve goals and not kind of water down our agency as a profession, that we assert our agency in new and meaningful different ways that are not being kind of taken from others at the table. And what I mean by that is, you know, some states don't require an architect for housing projects, for single family residential or multifamily residential up to a certain point, or interior design or sustainability consulting. A lot of kind of what previously fell under the purview of an architect has been kind of carved out by other consultants that don't necessarily need a license in architecture. They don't need the education that an architect has. And so kind of at this moment in time, considering, well, what are we left with? Where and how do we assert our agency to, you know, protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public? Part of what I look at is, and part of what we talk about with NCARB and within our company is, you know, the built environment. How are we protecting the built environment? And what is the built environment? It's not just buildings, it's infrastructure. I'd argue the digital environment, the virtual environments, the regulatory environments are all built environments. And so there are certainly other ways for architects to assert agency in those spaces.
Yeah. And I think the last few decades, architects have sort of let a lot of that responsibility go to others, often in fear of litigation and liability. It's hard, right? It's very hard to do the work that you're doing. It's risky to do the work that you're doing. But there's great benefits to doing, not only for you and your firm, but also for the world, you know, that architects are involved in doing the work that you're doing. When architects are not involved in the built environment, you get boring, bland architecture that's not really architecture. It's just building. It's important that we're involved in every area of the built environment. Of all the projects that you've worked on, which is your favorite? What's your favorite and why?
It's always the one that's not yet built. It's always the one on the drawing board. One thing that we're working on right now that we're excited about, we are the prime engineer and architect of record for Governor's Island, is demolishing and building a couple new piers. And so we are the prime on that. And it's, you know, Governor's Island is a wonderful place within New York Harbor, but it's also the site of the Climate Solution Center of New York, of the world. And so that's, you know, an opportunity that we don't take lightly to be designing the landing into the Climate Solution Center, you know, only accessible by water. And so that's something that we are excited about. But I'm sure as soon as that's built, there'll be another one that's not yet built that'll be the most exciting.
A very historic location. Governor's Island is right off the tip of Manhattan in New York City Harbor. Was the fence to New York City during the Revolution. Very, very important location. And really was a military location, right, for most of its life?
Correct. And that's what the current piers were built to service, large, you know, naval vessels that aren't what we need, practically speaking, today in order to service the island. And so that's part of the opportunity is, you know, how to redesign new piers that do speak to what the community of today and tomorrow need and what the vessels and technology, you know, the trajectory that we're on to be able to accommodate those.
So the Climate Change Center is there. What is the island being transformed to become?
There are various tenants to the way the island operates. They lease out the different parcels, not even lots, but many are kind of incubation programs, climate themed. There are also various companies that set up their headquarters there. And so it's really kind of changing with the times to offer something that, you know, anywhere else you look in New York is fully kind of built out. And Governor's Island is kind of one of the last places that you have, you know, parkland and you have nature and you're, you know, on the water's edge. And it's just a little bit of a oasis within New York that you're have a moment in connection with nature aside from the hustle and bustle of the city.
Yeah. And it's all served by ferries, right? That's the only way you can get there.
Yep. All by water.
Yeah. New York is a fascinating place, especially when you understand the history of New York and how it became what it is today. It's a really very unique, interesting city. One of my favorites, for sure. So before we wrap up, Tina, I ask everybody one question that I ask everyone at the end of every episode. You're speaking with thousands of small firm architects who are no doubt very inspired by you right now from the work that you've done and the firm that you've built. What is one thing that you can recommend that small firm architects do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think something that's helped me is to consider and reconsider the individuals I'm surrounding myself with, because at the end of the day, we are a reflection of the top, you know, 3, 4, 5 people that we surround ourselves with. And so if you are surrounding yourself with people who are elevating you, bringing you up, helping you grow, that reflects in you and the work that you do. And so I think that only helps to benefit our companies and our environments that we practice in.
Her name is Dina Prastos. Learn more about Indigo River at indigoriver.com. Awesome that you got that URL. Nice and easy to remember, indigoriver.com. I love the name. What inspired the name?
The name is, my dog is named Indigo, and I had a picture of her on the river, and it was initially intended to be a placeholder name, and it just kind of stuck and assigned a little more meaning to it down the road.
I'm glad it stuck. I love the name. IndigoRiver.com. Go check them out. Go say hi to Dina. Go be inspired by the work that they're doing. And thank you, Dina, for the work that you're doing. Very important work. I love that you have taken a lead in the profession and have shown us the way. So thank you for doing that. And thanks for coming by here and sharing a little bit of your story and your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
And thank you so much for having me, Mark.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect. That's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember 3 words: love, learn, share. Have a great day.
I've mentioned it to my family, but in terms of telling people like, oh yeah, we're doing this, I'm looking for projects, you got anything? Yeah. I'm not there yet because it scares the shit out of me.
Dreaming of launching your own architecture firm? Well, buckle up for a wild ride with Emerging, the podcast that shares what it's really like to start an architecture firm.
Where do we begin? We don't even know what type of business to formalize as. Is it an LLC? Is it an LLP? Like, how are taxes? I mean, the list is astronomical.
Season 1 featured founders Jeffrey, Lexi, and Chris, owners of Level Studio Architecture, are your fearless guides on this unfiltered journey from napkin sketches to a thriving studio.
One evening, stumbled into one last dive, we sat at the bar and pondered our postgraduate futures. Amidst the conversation, a napkin became the canvas for our aspirations, sketching plans and milestones, sealing our heartfelt commitment and shared dreams.
In drawing down dreams on a napkin collectively, that then, you know, in your head, you've rooted like, oh, I'm connected to these people, like, long term.
The process of starting an architecture practice brims with excitement and challenges, demanding meticulous planning, flawless execution, and unyielding resilience.
I kind of hate the term because it's so overly used, but I think everybody knows imposter syndrome. And I think it's so real to this day. I don't know if it's with everybody, but with me, I'm always questioning like, us, can we do this? Are we ready to do this? Are we prepared? Can we do it?
Did we just decide a name?
We did it, guys.
Oh my
God. That came out of nowhere.
Woo! It came out of nowhere. I liked it. I saw it.
Ready to turn your aspirations into reality? Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Emerging and chart your own path to architectural success.
Calling all small firm architects, it's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my 2 favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast, it's a community where dreams meet action.
there's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.